Good evening, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atzid and Web Yeshiva with another installment in Jews, Judaism, and Modernity, our explorations of modern Jewish history, our conversation on anti-Semitism, at least in this wave of it, is coming to a close. We spent quite a number of weeks at the beginning of the semester talking about Eastern European Jewry, and now we're talking about Western European Jewry. And tonight I want to dedicate to among the most infamous parashiot, tales, stories, events in modern Jewish history. That, of course, is the Dreyfus Affair, which is not merely an exemplar of how anti-Semitism played itself out in the modern world, but of course was so very much an event that resonated throughout history, still to this day resonates in different ways, particularly in, if you live in France, the impact of this particular event on French public life, political life, cultural life, is still really very quite profound until this day, you know, in a way that it's still very much a very raw subject 100+ years later, but elsewhere as well. And of course, the Dreyfus Affair, the outline of which I assume is familiar to all of you, but the Dreyfus Affair as a domino event that kicked off other things that are, of course, very important to us and things which will require more careful analysis. It's also, of course, important because it's an incident that draws to focus the way that the study of history goes both macro and micro, looks at the sweep of large events, the arc of history unfolding over the course of years and decades and centuries, millennia, but also the degree to which then singular events and even unlikely people, unlikely individuals enter the stage of history and, you know, events happen and almost turn on a dime. I assure you that Alfred Dreyfus did not anticipate that he was going to become a figure around which history, French history, Jewish history would revolve. One assumes he did not welcome it. Of course, as we move along the evening, we'll see there were other individuals who were profoundly impacted on because of this event. And those individuals went on to themselves have a profound impact on Jewish life, Jewish culture, Jewish history, as we will see. Again, I assume that the outline of the story is familiar to most of us, but it's worthy of review. By 1900, by the turn of the century, the Jews in France made up probably at most 80,000 people, which is a little over 1/10% of the population. Most of the Jews in France are lower middle class, but there are a few notable millionaires that stick out. And that's enough to stir a type of social anti-Semitism particularly amongst French socialists, who can point to these these singular individuals and say, see, the Jews control capital, the Druze control industry. You know, these claims that we've heard before, the Jews control Hollywood, the Jews control, etc. These ideas that will pop up in the protocols of the Elders of Zion, etc. Unlike Germany, which we discussed, I think, in our last session when we met 2 weeks ago, last week, of course, we didn't meet, it was Hanukkah. Unlike Germany, anti-Semitism never gains the respectability of government approval. And Jew hatred begins to lose some of its effectiveness because it doesn't have that government-sanctioned imprimatur. Excuse me, I apologize. I'm fighting off a cold, as you can hear. Then, pitom, all of a sudden, a packaged off the shelf, ready made, a made to order scandal explodes in time to give anti-Semitism that boost that it needs to reestablish it as a tool of the right wing. And that, of course, is the Dreyfus Affair, the details of which are as follows. In 1894, in September of 1894, a French spy finds a suspicious piece of paper in a garbage can of the German military attaché. Germany and France, while not actively at war at this point, are rivals, are always suspicious, there's always tensions along the French-German border. And a French spy finds a letter. Do I have it here? Yes, we have it here. Here it is. Here is, I think, courtesy of the French National Archives. This is the actual document itself, which is available on Wikipedia. Of course, you could get a better resolution copy of it if you speak French. You can actually read it. My 2 years of high school French did not avail themselves in a way that I could actually read it. But this is the actual document. I always think that it's, you know, to see actual documents, that they're actual, just like they're people, you know, around whom history turns. You know, there's that old, you know, high school essay that you had to read, write probably, if you could meet any figure from history, who would it be and why? You remember writing such things, I'm sure. So we can't do that, of course, because we don't have time machines. We can't go back and meet Ben Gurion. We can't go back and meet Moses Montefiore. We can't go back and meet Rabbi Akiva Eger. We can't go back and meet the Rambam. We can't do that. But they're actual pieces of paper. Actual pieces of paper written. And the piece of paper, the embodiment of an idea, is a physical artifact. 2 years ago, there was this exhibit here at the Israel Museum. You know, the Israel Museum in Yerushalayim underwent this major renovation. So while they were doing this renovation work, most of the museum was closed, and they had in a side hall, they had these special exhibits. So they had this, I think it was in 2008 for the 60th anniversary, they had 60 documents from the Israeli National Archive displayed. 60 important documents. The National Archives here in Israel, unlike in America where you can go to Washington and you can visit the National Archives and they have on display the original Declaration of Independence, the original Constitution. They have a copy actually of the Magna Carta. There are multiple copies of the original Magna Carta from England. One of them is on display in the National Archives, the Bill of Rights, as well as other very important historical documents on display. And you can see them in Israel. The National Archives doesn't have that for some reason, but they had this particular exhibit. And you could go and see the Megillat Atzma'ut, the Israeli Declaration of Independence, the actual, you know, you've seen copies of it. But I was unaware, because I've seen replicas of it so many times, I was unaware that the actual Declaration of Independence of the State of Israel had not ever been displayed. I'm trying to find here. I'm putting a link in the chat. But the actual document itself, with the actual signatures, had never been displayed to the public. I thought that was fascinating. And they had it on display. They had other things as well. They had the peace treaty with Egypt. The peace treaty signed at the White House after the Camp David Accords, with Begin, Sadat, and Carter's signature. They had the piece of paper with the Shir LaShalom, or the Shir HaShalom, which Rabin had folded in his pocket, in his breast pocket, when he was assassinated. And I mean, it was actually bloodied. But it was the song that they were singing on the stage, the song of peace they were singing on the stage the night he was assassinated. And a few other, what else, Lonnie? What else did they have that exhibit? The peace treaty with Jordan, not the Balfour Declaration. No. Oh, the Chok HaShvut, the law of return, that most important law passed in the early years of the Knesset, granting the automatic right of return and citizenship to any Jew. That citizenship is automatically available to him merely upon a desire. Im tirtzu ein zu agada, all you have to do is show up to any Jew. And he was listening. So the actual piece of paper passed, signed in the Knesset. And also the Ilan Ramon, the Israeli astronaut. What was it? My wife is sitting here. She's helping me. Ah, right. Ilan Ramon, when he went up in the space shuttle, the first Israeli to go in the space shuttle, he, even though he himself was not personally observant, his father was a Holocaust survivor, and he felt very strongly about, being a representative of the State of Israel. So he wanted to make a kiddush on Friday night, and he asked a shaila of, I think, of the Rav Rashi, of how and when do you make kiddush in space, and he had a piece of paper with a text of kiddush, and it was one of the actual artifacts that was rescued or was found in the debris of the space shuttle, and it was also charred. And they had, so anyway, they had all these these 60 historic documents. To the encounter with the actual physical artifact, the embodiment of ideas, or the encapsulation of significant moments in history, in Jewish history, I personally, maybe I'm just nostalgic like that, I think that the ability to encounter these physical artifacts. Alan, thank you, just posted a link. Is it, what is this? Yes, thank you, Alan. This is a link to that exhibit. And there's a virtual tour here, I see, and you should do it. It's worth seeing. It looks like it's worth visiting that site. So here it is. Here's the actual piece of paper found the piece of paper that kicked off the Dreyfus affair. So this September 1894, a French spy finds this suspicious piece of paper in a garbage can at the German military attaché. It contains a promise written in French to basically to pass state secrets of valuable French military intelligence, an artillery manual to pass it to the Germans. The chief of French military intelligence can't match the handwriting to anyone, but is persuaded by an aide, someone by the name of Major Hubert Joseph Henry, Henry, H-E-N-R-Y in English, but in French it's pronounced Henri, that the most likely culprit is a particular artillery officer named Captain Alfred Dreyfus, who at this point is 35 years old. It's about 35 years old. Dreyfus was rich. He was reportedly snobbish. And most significantly, was a Jew. Although his handwriting doesn't match the handwriting on this document, he was arrested, and he was court-martialed, and he was accused of treason. This famous image of the degradation of Dreyfus. This is an image that appears in different guises, in different ways, but of him being stripped of his military rank, and his sword being broken as a sign of his degradation, of being publicly humiliated. Henri, this aide to the head of French military intelligence, said that there was other evidence against Dreyfus, but he could not reveal that evidence because of the fear of revealing other national security secrets. Although, apparently, according to, you know, all historical work, there really was no other evidence. And that idea that, you know, well, we know him to be guilty, but we can't show you the evidence, take us on our word. You know, this, of course, is a device of governments of bad faith. And it's something which we've seen again and again and again in different contexts. And it is, of course, the importance for separation of powers. It is, of course, the importance for judicial review. It is, of course, speaks to the importance of the dangers of invoking state secrets as a defense against railroading whatever it is that you want to get rid of. Headlines, editorials are devoted to the topic of the international Jewish conspiracy. They're convinced the press, the public outcry has a very strong impact. The military court convicts him to life imprisonment on Devil's Island at the end of 1894. In the beginning of January of 1895, he's paraded through the streets of Paris to the shouts of "Death to the Jews," and he, of course, was stripped of his rank and of his uniform. Devil's Island was a penal colony off of the northeastern shore of South America. It was a French colony off of French Guyana, which is right to the north to the northwest of Brazil on the map. So off the coast of French Guyana is this island, kind of like, think of, if you know the American references, so then it's kind of like the Alcatraz. It's, of course, very, very far from France. You know, family can't come to visit. It's quite a long distance. by sea. If you ever saw that, it haunts me to this day, that old movie with Steve McQueen, Papillon, which is, I think, also based on a true story. It's based upon, or loosely based upon, the story of the only person that ever actually escaped from Devil's Island. Probably was imprisoned there around the same time, maybe a little later, I'm not sure. Steve McQueen, Dustin Hoffman, Papillon, a movie from the 60s, I'm sure. It's a very stark depiction of what life on Devil's Island was like, and he is sent there, life imprisonment. In March of 1896, a year after he's already been sent off to Devil's Island, the same French spy uncovered another letter in the same office, in the same handwriting, promising further military secrets. This is a problem. Why is this a problem? No? Why does the discovery of this second document create a wrinkle in the story? Well, not just that another scapegoat needs to be found, but it's another document written in identical matching handwriting over a year after Dreyfus has been locked away a continent away on Devil's Island. He couldn't have been the author of the second document, and if he couldn't have been the author of the second document, then obviously he wasn't the author of the first document. And he's an innocent man imprisoned for life on Devil's Island. From our perspective now, it just seems a no-brainer that this should have automatically, that day they should have released him from prison. But that's not what happened. The handwriting was connected to a different officer. Somebody named Walson Esterhazy. Unfortunately, I was unable to find pictures of these characters. And the boss of Henri, remember, Henri was the underling who made the connection between the first document and Dreyfus, even though the evidence was against it. Henri's boss, Colonel Picquart, makes this connection to this. Points the finger at this Esterhazy, who was not Jewish. Esterhazy was a drunkard and a gambler and a womanizer and all those other good qualities. The best hunch seems to be that he got involved in this espionage and passing secrets to the Germans for profit in order to support these fine habits that he had. And when Picquart confronts Henri with the evidence, wanting to go public, Henri basically forces his hand into a corner and says, "How can the army admit that it made a mistake without tarnishing its honor?" Now, the army, as a national institution, as a cultural institution, the role of honor in French society was such at the end of the 19th century that these were very, very delicate questions. Henri then goes and forges new evidence against Dreyfus, and then somehow, using some connections he had, gets Picquart, the only other person that knows. Or the only other person that's, kind of convinced that he knows who the real culprit is, he gets him transferred away to Tunisia to get him off the stage. Before he leaves, however, Picquart has the information sent to a member of the Senate, to a liberal member of the Senate, who uncovers the army's desire to protect its honor, that the army's desire to protect itself was standing in the way of that other great French value, equality before the law. Remember, liberté, égalité, fraternité. Understanding what had happened. This was, of course, all before WikiLeaks. It was a pre-modern version of WikiLeaks, I guess. This all becomes public. There's a campaign for a retrial, but the retrial again is still, it's not a trial in a civil court. These were military courts. They were military court martials. Again, these ideas resonate with us in the modern era. And since the military was controlling the trial, they find Esterhazy innocent, and they can't undo the charges of Jewish treason. In response to Esterhazy's acquittal, in January of 1898, a journalist named Emile Zola, here he is, here's Zola, Emile Zola, 1840 to 1902. Emile Zola is a... Emile Zola is also non-Jew. He's something... He's a journalist and a writer and a novelist. He was a playwright also, I think. He was somewhat eccentric by all accounts. He publishes among the most famous... pieces of journalism. You think of in this century, you think of Woodward and Bernstein. It wasn't a piece of investigative reporting, but it was an open letter addressed to the president of France under the name J'accuse, I accuse. Uncovering the miscarriage of justice, accusing the military people who were responsible by name, charging them with conspiracy. He himself, Zola himself, was convicted of libel, but he fled the country to England and avoided jail time. And this front page attack on January 13th, 1898, J'accuse, this long essay, this accusatory piece of journalism, among the most famous pieces in the history of journalism, really changed the tide. If you go to Wikisource, this link, Wikisource, you can find a full English translation of Zola's piece of J'accuse, which is worth reading. By the summer of 1898, this is written in January 1898. Right? In other words, Esterhazy was acquitted on January 12th. The next day, Zola publishes the essay, and still nothing has happened. Dreyfus has been sitting in prison since the beginning of 1895. By the summer of 1898, the public outcry was so great that all of the evidence was looked into again, and the forgery and the dishonesty was uncovered. Henri was thrown into jail for his part in the whole scandal, for manipulating the evidence and for basically railroading Dreyfus when the evidence didn't support Dreyfus, and for what he did to Picard, who was the one person that was onto the truth. and he's put into jail, and he commits suicide. You know, I guess he's left with a razor blade in the cell, and he commits suicide on his very first night in prison. Now it becomes apparent that Dreyfus deserves a retrial. He'd been in prison since 1894, first imprisoned in France, and then sent off to Devil's Island. He's sitting in Devil's Island all these years, assuming that he's been completely forgotten. In June of 1899, he's finally sent back to France. He walks into the courtroom. He's dazed. He's gaunt. He's balding. He's gray. The evidence seems so overwhelmingly for him. It seems so apparent that he had been framed, but yet the court martial again finds him guilty. They reduce his sentence to only 10 years from life imprisonment, but the liberal president of France named Loubet, Loubet, Emile Loubet, grants him a pardon merely to silence the whole affair. The whole thing had become such a black eye for France that he's granted a pardon, if for no other reason than to get it off the headlines. But a pardon, of course, only means, and as a pardon means that you did it, you're guilty, you've been punished, but we're going to excuse it. But we're not saying that you're innocent. A pardon means accepting a pardon means almost that you're accepting that you're guilty. But see, of course, he accepts the pardon, doesn't want to go back to Devil's Island. And it takes 7 years, only 7 years later in 1906, was he completely exonerated? Was he completely exonerated? The Dreyfus affair again becomes this turning point around which the question of Jews' role in society and the ability of the Jew to integrate into society. Here's someone who, lichora, had made it. He was assimilated. He was a Frenchman first. And yet, look what they do to him. This is a political cartoon that was very apparently widely disseminated. The Museum of Horrors, the traitor. A snake, a serpent, a monster. The affair is just this encapsulation of the question of, okay, after Jewish emancipation, after equality, after the Jews' ability to rise to high ranks in all positions, are they ever going to be fully accepted into the larger society? And this question is asked, this question is planted into the head of a young journalist by the name of Theodore Herzl, here in a picture from much later, who was covering the trial of Dreyfus in France. Herzl himself is Viennese, but he travels to France, or he's in France during the trial, and he's covering it as a journalist. And this question is planted into the head of Herzl here in this most famous of all pictures of Herzl looking out over the balcony in Basel, where he created the Jewish state, he said, looking his most visionary, his most dare I say, is most messianic in this picture. And the question of, can the Jew ever really become a partner, in a full partner, in the host society? Or need the Jew form a society of his own? And that's what I mean by the Dreyfus Affair being, again, the Dreyfus Affair was about one particular Jew. You look at other events, the pogroms in Kishinev, where dozens of Jews were killed. Obviously, when weighing one life against another, looking at the profundity, but the impact of an idea, the impact of a question that becomes encapsulated by an event like the Dreyfus Affair has such profound impact on the next 50 years of world history, of European history, of Jewish history, that it takes on proportions, monumental proportions, above and beyond the particular case and the particular man. And that is the story and the impact of the Dreyfus Affair. Dreyfus himself, of course, lived until 1935, 30 years more. There are pictures of him available online of a very old, withered man. Although he actually served, he continued to serve in the French army. He was reinstated into the French army, and he actually served in World War I. So the story of Dreyfus himself is a tragic one. The impact of having been imprisoned on Devil's Island apparently left its toll on his health, and on him personally, but. Hold on, I'm looking for an answer to your question. Yes, hold on. Correct. Sherry makes this point about Zola. In other words, Zola was... Look, in other words, it's a good comparison. I mentioned Woodward and Bernstein. Whose contribution in Watergate was a little different because they actually uncovered what was happening in Watergate. Zola was just the one that put facts that apparently were known together and named names and pointed the finger. But we tend to think of Woodward and Bernstein, colored by all the president's men, as these people working in isolation. There were many other reporters that were covering the story and were making significant revelations. History likes to find a hero. Zola wasn't the only liberal journalist or man of letters or public intellectual that was leading the cry. He's just been remembered as the one that pointed the finger because he did it in the most impactful and famous way. He wasn't alone in doing it, but it's correct that what Sherry says, how many others never had a champion like Zola to plead their cause and were never heard of? That's probably also true. Yeah. Okay. That's a historian's that's the historian's parlor game. You know, what would have happened if Hitler had bought it in World War I, what would have happened? So, similarly, we don't know. Maybe there would have been a different Hitler. So that is the story of Dreyfus. I'll just repeat something. I started a conversation with Alan at the beginning of the hour. I don't know if all of you were yet on. Next semester, we have one more class left next Tuesday. We'll try to wrap up. Next semester, we're changing things around a little bit. The course that I normally teach on Thursday nights about the Rambam will continue, but in this Tuesday night slot, and instead of Jewish history in this format, we'll subsequently, after a break, we'll come back and we'll pick up with the history of Zionism. But starting next semester, there'll be a separate notice about this, we're going to be offering a course on the writings of Shai Agnon, particularly trying to ferret out the sources in traditional Jewish sources on which he drew to create his masterful Nobel-winning pieces of literature. Alan had asked to do some homework. I recommended there's a volume called A Book That Was Lost, which was, Alan just posted the link to it on Amazon. It's an anthology of 35 short stories by Agnon translated into English, and that will serve as the basis for the course. So if people want to do some advanced reading on that, they can buy that book, which I recommend. I see that it's available on Amazon. It's probably also available if you have a local Jewish bookstore, or if you're here in Israel and you have access to Stematsky, or to the publisher, Toby Press, which is located in Yerushalayim. If you need to contact them, let me know, and I will send you their contact information. But you can take a look at that